Coming up on Open Source with Tony Motley, Africa has many investors seeking opportunities to connect with entrepreneurial ventures and startups. What are the opportunities and barriers for these entities?
Most of the things we do with our entrepreneurs, we take a human-centered design approach. So what we do is we always depart in what exactly are in it for every single human in this system that you're about to disrupt. What are their current interests and how will that look like if you're introducing the change?
Through his company, Growth Africa, founder and CEO Johnny Kelsgaard is working with investors and business owners to create opportunities and grow opportunities in Africa. Johnny Kelsgaard, welcome to Open Source.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about me. Africa is a continent and not a country. And so, especially in the West here, we say Africa, I mean, it could be anything. It's like saying I'm going to America. You could be in Mexico, Canada, Central America, you could be anywhere. So what spots in Africa are ripe for investment and growth?
I think that's a bit of a tricky question because obviously mid COVID crisis, I'd probably encourage most investors to be a bit cautious, but that's not just true for Africa. That's perhaps true across the entire planet. But the more developed parts of Africa in terms of investment would certainly be South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, and most of North Africa, where there isn't an ongoing conflict, is also interesting. Egypt, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, those countries are also good spots for investing.
And so these opportunities, I'm sure they're diverse. Are they tech opportunities? What are we looking for?
So there's a lot of diversity, and even the different regions and the different countries in each of the regions will have things that are very specific to them. I think Africa has mostly been known for opportunities relating to natural resources, and that is to an extent still true, though they have often been very exploitive in nature. And they do require quite a hefty investment if you're building up a diamond mine or an oil field. So those are not necessarily opportunities that we facilitate a whole lot of. What we tend to focus on with our entrepreneurs and with our investors are opportunities that are a little bit less capital intensive, and where, generally speaking, those opportunities are ripe. Besides IT and ICT, tech in general is also in ag. Right now, health and education are also areas that are ripe for investing. Access to energy and energy distribution, especially if it takes into consideration rural areas and areas that are hard to electrify using traditional infrastructure. Those are also areas that are quite interesting from an investment perspective.
And I was aware of solar from Africa maybe 15 years ago. How has solar expanded now? And what innovations have we seen in solar energy?
I'd say there has perhaps not been that many innovations besides the fact in the technology itself. So, I mean, PV panels have, of course, become a lot more effective. I think it's the innovation that we've seen in the solar sector is perhaps around the business model itself, where there's has been a proliferation of pay per consumption, pay as you go type solutions with an integration of mobile payments, especially here in Kenya, the birthplace of M-Pesa, which was years ahead of any other mobile payment anywhere else in the world. And the integration with that specific mobile payment solution and access to electricity has been expanding across not just Kenya, but across most of Africa, into the rest of East Africa, Ghana, and a few places in Southern Africa as well.
And so I think mobile payments is a unique, it's kind of a level the playing field in some regard, I would imagine, because it's making it easier for people to do these transactions. Talk about the mobile payments and what that sector is like right now.
I think that one of the reasons that mobile payment took off so rapidly is actually the lack of banking by most of the population. I think we only need to go around 10 or 15 years back to have had a banking penetration of less than 10%. So less than 10% of the population would have had access to a bank account, but they still had a need for access to financial services. And mobile payment became an easy way to leverage the infrastructure of the mobile telephone that was already in the hands of a lot of people, certainly a lot more people than had bank accounts. So integrating a financial service with the mobile phone became an obvious way of kind of bridging that gap of the unbanked. And so I think that innovation and that logic of combining financial services with the mobile handset just was an obvious one at the time, but in hindsight has been quite revolutionary because it's given access to financial services to almost in Kenya almost the entire population.
And so what people do is they go to some retail store or somewhere to put money on their phone so they can do these transactions. How does that work?
Right. So there is still the same KYC requirements as a bank would have, so know your customer. So there is still a need for you to identify yourself. Luckily, in Kenya and in a few other countries, that's pretty straightforward because we do have a national ID system. So just leveraging off the national ID system, you take your national ID to an agent, and the agent then establishes your account. That is also the same agent that would be the point where you either would put money into or take money out of your account. But there isn't actually a whole lot of need for money to kind of go in and outside of the system. A lot of people are being paid. Let's say you're a farmer and you're supplying some of your outputs from your farm. You will be paid in M-Pesa, in mobile money. And you would go to the market where you would buy your groceries, your tomatoes and your onions and your rice, and you would pay with M-Pesa. So there isn't necessarily a great need any longer to kind of sit outside of the mobile money system because a lot of money is circulated within the national system of this mobile money.
That's very interesting. So how has that impacted traditional banking, or do they go play side to side in this kind of transactions?
Yeah, they have certainly been playing catch up to some extent. And there was a big push in the early days by the banks to get this mobile money system thrown out. And actually quite a number of countries initially was very skeptical with this whole thing. And that skepticism was born out of a concern from the banks. Ever since, especially in Kenya, and I think the reason Kenya became kind of the birthplace of this was that the government said to the banks, you have to catch up. You have to innovate your way out of this. And this has been true for most banks across the continent, that they've simply had to either invent their own solutions or integrate with the existing solutions provided by the mobile network operators.
Now, so that mobile banking system is, I guess, an assistance to investors, like you talked about, even on down to the granular level with farmers and so on. But it makes it easier to conduct business, I would assume. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, the speed with which you can transact is much higher and much safer than it would be if you were to operate with cash. So that's improved both the access to business, but also the kind of the turnaround time with which you would get paid. You would get paid almost instantaneously, whereas the mode by which a farmer would get paid in the past would be you'd have to wait for a month for all of these payments to accumulate. Then you'd be given a check. You then have to travel to the closest city where there was a branch of a business that could then cash that check, and then you'd get the cash. All of that has now been bypassed, and people can essentially get access to the money and use that money almost instantaneously.
So then, when you say invest in Africa, who are these investors, and what kind of return are they, or what are they seeking?
The investors are primarily, interestingly enough, not African. We see a lot of investors from the US and North America, a lot of investors from Europe. There is a lot of government influence, so a lot of the Western countries have their own investment vehicles that are frequently government funded, that would sit alongside some of the private investments being made. But very few of them are actually investments coming out of Africa itself. A lot of the wealth being generated in Africa, paradoxically enough, actually goes to be invested outside of Africa, because there is a perception that even by Africans, that investing in Africa is risky. So a lot of the money that comes in from Europe and the US and North America and even Asia, we're seeing Asian countries investing a lot more now, Japan than China, and Korea taking the lead there, being capital that is perhaps on the fringes. It's not a kind of risk averse capital. It is investors who have an appetite for high risk, but also are expecting a relatively high return. So it's not uncommon that people have expectations in the range of 14, 18, 20% return on an investment that they're making here.
And is that kind of return? That's tremendous return. Is that happening?
It is. I wouldn't say across the board. I was more speaking to the intent, but there are certainly areas where you would see that level of return. The more common, and if you talk to some of the aggregators of investors, they'd probably say the average IRR is closer to the higher end of single digits, so 8 or 9%. But that's still a pretty lucrative return when you're in markets where you have close to 0% interest.
And so what sectors are really expanding right now? And what's the need, say, even in Kenya, what are the needs there for investors, for business? What do people need there that would entice an investor?
Right. I think need is perhaps one side of the equation. Ability to pay for is the other side of the equation, right? So food is always a very safe bet. We do have an increasing population. We're 1.2 billion people at the moment, and that's trending upwards towards 1.5 and later in the century, 2 billion and more. And all of those people will need access to basic services, starting with food. So agriculture and investing in the ag value chains and optimizing these agricultural value chains is something that is a pretty safe bet. I think the moment you combine technology with agriculture, it becomes even more interesting. As you can imagine, there's a lot of opportunities, even in relatively basic systems locally. So we're not necessarily talking about very sophisticated and advanced technologies, but we're simply just talking about fixing the distribution from farm to market, from market to cities, and making export of certain goods and agricultural outputs more efficient. Those things sitting alongside the agricultural value chains on top of the agricultural output and input itself is certainly something that is a pretty safe bet.
So what about in the tech sector with mobile phones, with OTT, internet services? Where do we stand there?
I mean, the penetration is relatively high. It's not as high as you might see in Asia and Latin America, but it's still by far the majority, if not almost all of the adult population in Africa will have access to a mobile phone and all of the services that you'd be able to access on a mobile phone. And increasingly, that mobile phone is a smartphone, so they'd also be able to access relatively sophisticated services on those mobile devices. I'd say, generally speaking, technology needs to sit alongside a service that is physical. So as mentioning before, the agricultural value chains, if you're combining technology with that, the same with energy, and as I mentioned, the mobile payments, and the mobile payments in and of themselves is not necessarily of much value if they don't sit alongside or on top of an actual real need, so to speak. There's not perhaps a whole lot of cases that can be built around an Amazon or a Facebook in Africa. I think most of the technology and most of the technologies that we will see and have been seeing do sit alongside an already existing brick and mortar sector, but it's just sitting on top of that as an extra layer of efficiency.
So then when people get television services, for example, in Kenya, South Africa, what's that look like?
I mean, and we have actually seen that, so that's a good point. A lot of the middle class in the urban areas of Africa do have access to your Netflix, and even if you would have access to your Hulus and your Disney Plus. But having creating a case for a similar version of an African service would be, I wouldn't say it's been far-fetched, because you do have services, especially out of Nigeria, that is trying that. And you do have, out of South Africa, you have DSTV that is trying to do something similar. So from a content creation perspective, that might be a good argument to be made. But from an aggregation perspective, it becomes very difficult to be globally competitive. It is perhaps more likely that there will be a consolidation, if you're looking at it from a local content perspective, that there will be a consolidation around an international player rather than a local player. And that's, I think, access to kind of cutting edge technology and access to talent is some of the key drivers there that would make it very hard to remain competitive as an African business in those areas.
Now, you talked about education, and I'm wondering what's going on in the education sector there, and have you done any investment, encouraged any things there?
We have, but far less than I think is possible, and I think it's perhaps one of the less leveraged markets, and I think part of that is there is still a perception that this is a service that the government needs to provide. The matter of the fact is, unfortunately, that our education system across Africa is quite dismal. It may be relatively good in some of the bigger urban centers, but as soon as you get into the rural areas, the level of the facilities, the infrastructure in primary and secondary schools, and even the level of teachers in terms of what background they have and what training they themselves have received falls far short of what it ought to be. And the unfortunate effect is that means all students need to play catch up in terms of their education, because it's not being provided effectively. And if you're looking at a provider like Bridges International, they've tried to say, okay, fine, let's look at education, and especially primary education, as this is a pretty standardized solution. Let's equip all of the teachers with a tablet. And all they really need to do is just kind of read aloud the content from the tablet, and where possible, equip the students with a tablet. And I think it may sound silly in some years to say, let's put a tablet in the hands of an African kid who is essentially sitting under the tree rather than sitting in a real classroom. But I think that investment is perhaps much better than starting to build classrooms. It might even be better and more efficient to focus on applications and content for these tablets than education masses of teachers who would then, ineffectively deliver the same amount of content that an app can do. So I think there's a lot of things that we can do much more efficiently if we took a more private sector approach to education than was the case right now. But it's a sore topic, and a lot of governments still also believe that they have to be the ones who are providing, or at least controlling to some extent, what the education system looks like.
Interesting. That's interesting. It's kind of happens in the West in a similar way too, in the States here as well. But then at the same time, you've got government almost resisting fully investing in education as they should. When you started in the late 90s, what was the impetus? Why did you start Growth Africa?
Well, interesting enough, I started with a very hard IT focus because I was quite sure that Africa would easily be able to leapfrog a lot of development steps if it would embrace IT much more aggressively than ended up being the case. So I was a big proponent of Africa and African countries adopting IT solutions for pretty much every single aspect of their lives, not really factoring in that there is a human element to that as well. So I think it was perhaps, and this is 25 years ago, I was a lot younger and perhaps a lot more naive than I am today, a very naive notion of saying, well, the solution to all Africa's woes are in IT. And I think a lot of solutions still are in IT, but you cannot underestimate the human factor.
And what is the human factor, John?
Well, I think people are used to and often quite vested in the status quo and how things operate as it is. And certainly there's a lot of people who will resist change just because they have that vested interest. So whenever there's someone who's coming and disrupting a system, no matter if that's a government official or someone who benefits from the way a local rural market operates, they will do what they can in order to kind of protect their vested interests. So understand what those human dynamics are, even at the most micro of levels, need to be taken into consideration whenever you are trying to disrupt any system. If you add the alien or the potential alienating factor that IT can bring to the equation, then you probably have to trade even more carefully. If people all of a sudden are seeing electronic devices that they've never heard of and perhaps only fantasized about in the context of science fiction, then that has a way to alienate people and make them even more scared of the change that might be imminent. But as we've seen, especially with a lot of big government contracts, where you could say, well, it's bringing efficiency, it's bringing transparency and accountability to the table, there'll be a lot of people in the system who will lose power and lose leverage and lose opportunities, and they're not interested in that. So they'll do everything to undermine and even sabotage those changes.
Wow. Well, I tell you, that's disappointing. When you say
it's human nature,
it is.
I don't think we should fool ourselves. So if you do not kind of take those things into consideration when you're designing your approach, then I think what I've learned at least is then you're pretty much doomed from day one. So you do much better trying to figure out how humans likely to interact with and perhaps even protect the people who stand to do something if you try to protect them rather than remove their leverage, then they may be embracing that new technological change.
Is that even part of maybe your marketing strategy as you, some of these ventures, you begin with looking at those objectives?
Absolutely. I mean, in most of the things we do with our entrepreneurs, we take a human-centered design approach. So what we do is we almost always depart in what exactly are in it for every single human in this system that you're about to disrupt. What are their current interests and how will that look like if you're introducing the change? And by introducing the change, are there things you can do to mitigate so that they will not feel threatened by you coming and offering something new and different?
So what's the dollar amount, let's say, that you're looking to invest for these investors? What are they looking to spend? And how far does that money go?
So we operate in the relatively early stages of a business life cycle. They would be they would be revenue generating. Often they would not be kind of greenfield projects where they had not actually developed a prototype and launched that prototype into a market sense. And you can still get a long way with a relatively small amount of money. We would typically not look above $1 million. We would look somewhere between, typically between $100,000 and $500,000 as investment for this very initial stages, where the objective often is just to see an increase in uptake of the services. So perhaps push revenue from $50,000 or a couple of $100,000 towards the $1 million mark. And once we get towards the $1 million mark, then go out for a second round of investing, and then look for an amount that's beyond your $1 million amount. $1 to $5 million would typically be the ask when you get 1, 2, or 3 years down the road from the initial investment.
And so give me an idea of some of the, maybe one or two of the success stories that you've been involved with.
Well, there, I think one of the very big success stories that that we incubated in the very early stages is MCOPA. And MCOPA is one of the, if not the biggest provider of solar technology integrated with an M-Pesa solution. So where you're paying for your access to solar energy through mobile money. And they've grown to be just shy of 2,000 employees across 5 countries from the humble beginnings of just being incubated in our facilities way back in, and it started in 2011, so they're going towards their 10th anniversary. SoCo is another example of someone who's had a good amount of success. They have created a back-end infrastructure where they're allowing local jewelry makers to aggregate a jewelry, and then they sell that aggregated jewelry to high-end department stores, both in the U.S. and in Europe. I think Macy's and Debenham has in the U.S. has bought from them. And so what they provide is essentially that back-end infrastructure that allows the jewelry makers to ship, so the distribution infrastructure of shipping there, the jewelry to a central point where it's then repackaged and sent to Europe and the US, and then almost instantaneously through an integrated mobile payment solution, the local jewelry makers are then paid. And a third solution, it's a company called iProcure. They operate in the ag space, where, for lack of a better comparison, they're the Amazon of agriculture, of rural agriculture in Kenya.
And so those are all things. So, what's being done in terms of infrastructure, road building, bridge building, transportation?
Yeah. Well, the Chinese are investing heavily in that. And a lot of the rail infrastructure and the highway infrastructure has been built with Chinese money, and I think there is, and rightfully so, there's a growing concern that might increase the dependency on China in Africa, and I think it would be nice if we had a counter to that, but I think the foreign policy of a lot of Western governments, the U.S. in particular, has not really allowed for the U.S. to kind of counter some of those investments, which means that that the Western governments are perhaps becoming less relevant, or making themselves less relevant compared to a Chinese government in respect to infrastructure. But that, of course, has kind of knock-on effects in all aspects of the private sector.
Well, good. So if someone's listening to this in the West, in the States, what's the takeaway you want them to have? What opportunities are you suggesting for people in the United States to have in Africa?
I think they need to put away their prejudice. Africa is not how the media often portrays it, it's a lot more complex, a lot more diverse. And in that complexity and diversity are still a lot of gems that are hidden. So looking for those gems and partnering in a proper way with organizations who are on the ground and who has the experience of dealing in an African context is invaluable. I think the notion that you can, especially in these times, but even outside of this whole COVID craziness, that you can jump on a flight and kind of go find these opportunities yourself is perhaps a notion that's, you of course you can get lucky, but it's not something I would recommend. So partner with the right people on the ground, make sure you put your prejudice aside and you go into Africa with an open mind.
That's all really good information. I would suggest contacting someplace like Growth Africa, for example.
We'd be more than happy, Johnny.
I really appreciate you sharing this information with the open source audience, and we wish you all the best, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon. And to everyone else, thanks for listening. Share it, like it, tell a friend. This is Open Source with Tony Motley. We'll talk to you next time. Open Source with Tony Motley is a production of Duet Digital Media and McLaughlin Media.